Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello once again, and welcome to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Hausman. We're speaking today with Dr. Victoria Lamont, Associate Professor of English at the University of Waterloo. We'll be discussing her new book, Westerns, A Women's History, which came out with the University of Nebraska Press in 2016. Welcome to the New Books Network, Victoria.
Thank you.
First, why don't you tell us about yourself? What is your academic background, and what path did you take to becoming a scholar of literature?
I grew up in a sort of middle-sized city in Alberta called Edmonton. So it's a sort of Western location, kind of middle-class family. And I was always good at English. Won the English award in high school. Was a good writer and liked to write, liked to read. And I just couldn't imagine doing anything else. So I did a bachelor in English, and then I didn't want to stop. So I just kept going. That's how I ended up being an English professor.
It sounds like you got the bug early and just didn't let go of you.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what got you interested in the topic of Westerns as a genre for a monograph topic then?
I've been studying Westerns since I did my master's degree with Christine Bold at the University of Guelph. You might have heard of her recent book, The Frontier Club, just a really important and fantastic book. And one of my first graduate courses was with Christine, and it was called Women in the West. Christine also introduced me to the study of popular culture. It didn't occur to me that the English literary discipline could also include studying popular texts. And I've always been sort of a TV junkie. And the other thing that got me interested in Westerns was just or women's Westerns was just the learning how many women actually wrote Westerns. And that fascinated me as well. And these women were almost unknown to us today, but some of them were very well known in their own day. And it was just an open field. Nobody had read this stuff. And that was really exciting to me to study this body of text that had been forgotten for, you know, over 100 years. So it was the prospect of that discovery was also very exciting to me. So I've been working on women's Westerns since doing my master's degree.
So before we get into some of the arguments that you make in the book, mm-hmm. let's step back a little bit and start
sure.
with the kind of traditional story of
sure.
the development of the genre of the Western. What are some of the more typically canonical names and book titles that we hear about, and how did they become mm-hmm. the kind of the bedrock in this kind of traditional narrative about the genre's development?
Well, the story of the Western typically starts with James Fenimore Cooper, who wrote Last of the Mohicans and a bunch of other novels about a character called Leatherstocking or Hawkeye. There have been films made about him. So he was writing in the early 1800s. In the early 1900s, a writer called Owen Wister kind of updated his story created a cowboy character called the Virginian, who was the progenitor of the Western hero of the 20th century. So the dominant narrative has typically revolved around male frontier heroes, usually rescuing innocent or helpless, virtuous women from various threats, or protecting towns from various threats. So the role of the woman in the canonical or the sort of classic Western, if you want to call it, is kind of an object of desire and an object of rescue, but she doesn't really have any agency in her own right. And Westerns are typically thought to be written primarily by, about and for men. So that's the kind of canonical story. And still to this day, when I tell women, when I tell people that I study women writers of Westerns, they often say, "Oh, I didn't know women wrote Westerns." That's the kind of canonical story of the Western, if you will.
But as you've already said, that story leaves quite a bit out. And really the core argument of this book is that the list of authors and books that you just mentioned omits several women writers who contributed to the genre's conventions and to its popularity as well. And a lot of the writers that you talk about in the book were popular in their own right at their time. So before we're talking about who some of these writers are, why first do you think they were left out of the genre's history?
It's kind of a complicated story. But if I was to kind of make a long story short, I would say that around Western stories were not exclusively masculine terrain until the pulp magazines of the 1920s. And what happened in the pulp magazines was they started to kind of develop the genre categories that are familiar to us today. And part of creating genres involved targeting them towards narrowly defined groups. And particularly gendered groups. So you saw pulp magazines arise that were targeted towards young male readers, and you saw other genres targeted towards young women readers. And this really didn't happen until the 1920s. And the Western kind of split into, prior to this time, Westerns had been written by both men and women. And published in the same publications. As this gendering process happened in the 1920s, Westerns were subdivided into the action-adventure Western, which was marketed to male readers, and the romance Western, which was marketed primarily towards women readers. Skip later, a few decades later, scholars started deciding that the Western was worthy of study, and they tended to look at the action-adventure Western as the kind of original Western. And see the romance Western as the copy or as the imitation, as not really authentic, even though the two genres emerged simultaneously. And so the scholars in the kind of 50s and 60s, when they started constructing a canon of the popular Western, singled out figures like Owen Wister, Louis L'Amour, Max Brand, and that in terms of scholarship became known as the kind of history of the winter Western centered around these figures, and the women pretty much dropped out of that narrative.
Well, let's get in then to some of the works that you analyze and critique in your book. And let's talk first about Emma Gent Curtis. Who was she and what brought her to write stories about the American West?
She was fascinating.
Yeah, she really was. I loved that section of the book. It was really interesting.
So Emma Gent Curtis was a woman suffragist in Colorado. An interesting story of how I discovered her stuff was I was reading a book about women's suffrage in the West, and I asked myself, I wonder if any of these women suffragists actually wrote fiction or novels. So I ran them through some databases, and Emma Gent Curtis came up as having written two novels. And so I tracked them down on microfilm, and they both turned out to be about cowboys, but they were also pro-woman suffrage novels. So she was a woman suffragist in Colorado, and she wrote her novels as a means of promoting women suffrage in the West. Her protagonist in The Administratrix is a heroic cowboy, has a lot of the characteristics that we associate with the cowboy, sort of humble origins, a man of few words, chivalrous, has a kind of innate sense of morality and justice, and he's also, though, a woman suffrage advocate. And so at various parts in the novel, he talks about how poorly women are treated, and how if they had the vote, they could really do a lot to kind of improve their own situation. And I imagine that she probably wrote this novel, and gave it away or sold it at women's suffrage functions. She was a very prominent member of her community. When she died, the whole town came out to her funeral. She was a well-known political activist, and she just used her writing as a way to promote her politics, much like sort of following the model of Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin, using writing fiction as a way of getting people to change their minds about entrenched beliefs and ideas was a very common phenomenon in the 19th century. And so she was following on that tradition.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Curtis's book, The Administratrix, and what the story is in that book, and what you argue in the book, what it reveals about Curtis herself, and what people like her thought about the American West more generally?
Sure. So The Administratrix, the title of the work, it's an odd title.
Yeah,
it doesn't really connote the West or cowboys or any. And incidentally, it was published more than 10 years before Owen Wister's The Virginian. And it includes a lot of the same tropes that we associate with the Virginian and attribute to Owen Wister. And it turns out that Emma Gent Curtis was using these tropes 10 years earlier. So the Administratrix is about a young woman who is from the East Coast. She moves to a Western town to improve her health. She gets a job as a school teacher. She's from a kind of genteel, upper class, privileged background. She meets this cowboy who is kind of rugged and not quite up to her class, and she resists him, but he ultimately wins her over. So it's a very similar story to the story in The Virginian, which also involves a romance between a kind of upper class school teacher and a local cowboy who's sort of beneath her station socially, but turns out to have a kind of natural nobility that both of the heroines in these stories recognize. And then what happens in the Administration, it kind of makes a very kind of unusual turn in the plot, because the cowboy hero is murdered by a local group of, by a rival ranch, because he's such a successful rancher that he becomes a threat to the surrounding ranches. And so he is lynched and murdered. And so his widow decides that to get revenge, she's going to disguise herself as a cowboy and infiltrate the ranch where she suspects her husband's murderers are residing. And she becomes a cowhand at the neighboring ranch and kind of spies on them and finds out who exactly murdered her husband and waits for the right time. They're out on a roundup and confronts her husband's murderers. She's armed and basically gets revenge. She kills them in a kind of violent and sort of very melodramatic shootout. So it's a really, when I first read it, I was just blown away by this book. The cross-dressing, the woman gunfighter. And of course, now we see women gunfighters in all kinds of the neo-Westerns. Westworld, for example, has a woman gunfighter in it. But at this time, this period in the 1880s, late 1880s, it was just unheard of. So I was immediately just captivated by this story.
Yeah, and after reading the chapters that you spend on Curtis and the Administratrix, I was kind of surprised it hadn't been made into a movie yet, because that ending is so dramatic and it seems very cinematic. So it seems ripe for some producer to pick up on.
Yeah, for sure.
So tell us next about, let's talk about cattle rustling a little bit.
Okay,
that's
sure.
That's another important part of both kind of the mythos of the American West,
yes,
and within the genre of the Western itself. So tell us first what cattle rustling is, and how and why it's a recurring theme, both in some of the more well-known Westerns and in some of the lesser known texts that you describe in your book.
Well, in terms of the Western myth, Cattle rustling has been represented as the kind of classic struggle of good against evil. And so the cattle rustlers are generally depicted as criminals. They're lazy. They're not hardworking. And they're going after the hardworking rancher and stealing their cattle And the only way to stop them is through vigilante justice. Generally, in these kinds of narratives, the courts are ineffective, and the cattle rustlers, if they're taken, if they go to trial, the juries are too afraid to convict them, and so they. The only way to for justice to prevail is through vigilante justice. And so in the Virginian, for example, there's a very climactic scene in which the main character has to lynch his best friend because his best friend has turned cattle rustler. And even though this fellow, his name is Steve, is his best friend, he has to set that aside and say, justice demands that I hang or participate in the hanging of my best friend. So that's the kind of mythology of cattle rustling. The reality is a little bit murkier. In reality, cattle rustling was the process. It wasn't necessarily about stealing, because in those days you had unfenced ranges with cattle that belonged to many different owners in the area, and they would all get mixed together. Now, obviously, every spring the cattle would be rounded up and branded. With the brand of whatever ranch they belong to. And, but of course, sometimes you missed one. And so there would be unbranded cattle wandering around on the range. And these unbranded cattle were considered the property of whoever found them. And so cowboys, to kind of get ahead, would go out to rustle up some cattle, right? They would go out and look for unbranded cattle because that was pretty much the only way that could start his own herd. Cattle rustling became a kind of bone of contention as the cattle industry became threatened by a series of bad winters, kind of an unsustainable economic model. And so ranchers experienced a lot more losses of their herds. And so these unbranded cattle became more and more valuable. And cowboys who owned cattle became more and more of a threat. So one way to sort of counter the threat of the cowboys who were running their own cattle herds was to accuse them of being rustlers. And then you could sort of set them up on trumped up charges, and many of them were lynched, and so that's the sort of so cattle rustling was much more of a gray area in reality, and some of the women writers that I've studied actually take that on, and they see cattle rustling as more of a form of class struggle than a form of good against evil. And their stories of cattle rustling are much more complicated and kind of realistic in the way that they treat that history.
You also mentioned the importance of branding in the cattle industry, and branding comes up again and again as a theme in a couple of the works that you talk about in your book. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, particularly in the context of marriage, I think you talk about. Yeah, could you tell us a little bit more about that? Why branding is this important theme that is reoccurring throughout some of the works that you cover?
I noticed in several of the women authored Westerns that they really pay attention to branding as a kind of metaphor. So they B.M. Bauer, for example, she's got a novel called Lonesome Land, and she spends a lot of time in that book drawing this analogy between the branding of the female cow as this kind of piece of property, and she identifies that figure with the figure of the married woman, who's also kind of figures as a piece of property in patriarchal marriage. And I noticed that trope runs through its several of these novels of Westerns written by women. So they took on cattle branding as a kind of feminist trope, and they used it as a way of critiquing patriarchal marriage. There's another novel by Frances McElrath that also deals with the cattle branding trope and with cattle rustling. And there's a love relationship in that text between a cowboy and, same thing, a young school teacher. And he proposes to her. She turns him down, and he becomes disillusioned and becomes a cattle rustler. And then he kidnaps her. So she is identified with the rustled cattle. And so there's a very explicit analogy drawn between the idea of a woman as property and the explicit way in which cows are also treated as property.
You mentioned B.M. Bauer. Can you tell us about her and how her experience and her story speaks to what you call the myth of the pseudonym in the genre of the Western?
Sure. So B.M. Bauer, B.M. stood for Bertha Muzzy Bauer. And she was the first writer to really popularize the Western. She had a novel published in 1904 called Chip of the Flying U. And it was a huge success. And she got a contract with Popular Magazine to write the equivalent of two novels a year, plus dozens of short stories. And she wrote prolifically until she died in 1940. She preceded a lot of the male figures that we associate with the popular Western, specifically Zane Grey, but also people like Louis L'Amour, Max Brand, that we kind of identify as the ones who popularized the Western. But it was actually a woman. It was Bertha Muzzy Bauer that was the first woman to sort of take that story of the cowboy, the cattle frontier, turn it into a formulaic genre, if you will. So her publisher insisted upon her publishing under her initials and just letting the readers assume that B.M. Bauer was a man. And so she published under the signature B.M. Bauer for the rest of her life. And she really hated that. She really wanted people to know that it was a woman who was writing these incredibly popular books. And she really resented that her publishers wouldn't let her kind of do any publicity. But what I found about pseudonyms, there was this huge assumption that people would make about women's Westerns, that they all wrote under pseudonyms because it was a masculine genre, and that there's no way that they could publish as women unless they used pseudonyms. But that's actually not true. B.M. Bauer was the only Western writer, women Western writer that I've worked on that was forced to use to use a pseudonym. And the reason that her publisher did that was because she was so successful that they wanted to control her brand. And the way to do that was to not allow her to do any publicity, not allow her to gain any kind of celebrity status. Because if you had celebrity status at that time, then you had a little bit more leverage over your publisher, and maybe you could go to a different publisher, or maybe you could get more money. The film industry was doing the same thing at the time. It was not allowing its allowing its actors and actresses to publicize themselves because it would give them more leverage over the studios. So it wasn't really that B.M. Bauer it wasn't only about the fact that she was a woman writing in this so-called masculine genre, but it was more about how popular she was. And so because of that, her publishers just really wanted to control her name. And the less celebrity she had, the more they could control her. If you look at other women who were publishing Westerns at this time, none of them used pseudonyms. Carolyn Lockhart is an example. Another writer called Vinji Roe, Frances McElrath, Emma Gent Curtis. None of these women saw their gender as the kind of liability that would mean that people wouldn't read their stuff. And in fact, B.M. Bauer was well known in the local communities where she lived. She was well known as being the author of the B.M. Bauer books. And that was not scandalous to anyone. And B.M. Bauer tried at various times in her life to convince her publisher to let her do publicity. And she would say, you know, she was living in California in the 20s, and everyone in California knew that B.M. Bauer was Bertha Muzzy Bauer. And nobody was scandalized by it. Nobody was saying, oh, I'm never going to read another Bauer book again. And she would write to her publisher and say, listen, it's not a big deal. Why don't you let me do publicity? And they just would not let her do it. The idea that women could only write under pseudonyms is a myth. It only really applies to Bauer.
Toward the end of the book, you ask the question, why did Mourning Dove write a Western?
Oh,
so
yes.
So tell us, who was Mourning Dove, and how do you answer that question?
Mourning Dove was a member of the Colville Reservation in Washington State. And from a young age, her tribe was the Okanagan. She was a Salish speaker. From a young age, she was fascinated by books and fiction, novels. She liked to read dime novels when she was young. And by the time she was, I think she must have been maybe in her early 20s, she had gone to business school to Calgary, Alberta, so that she can learn how to type, so that she could write a novel and get it published. And so she wrote a novel called Kojawea. She wrote it as early as 1914. But she didn't have the connections that you would need to get it published at the time. So she kind of sat around until she met a white activist called Lucilius McWhorter. And he's the one that he found out that she had written a novel. And at that time, it was believed that this was the first novel written by an indigenous woman. It wasn't, but he decided that he would help her get it published. And so that's what he did. And after many years, they finally managed to get it published in, I think, 1928. Now, Kojuia is interesting because it does use a lot of Western tropes, which you would kind of think intuitively the Western has a long history of being an anti-Indigenous genre. It dramatizes, a part of what it does is dramatize kind of stereotypes about Indigenous people as being savages, as being as sort of a disappearing race. They're on their way out. They're a dying race. So why would Mourning Dove gravitate towards that genre? And what I argue in my book is that despite its kind of history as this colonial narrative, it's a more attractive alternative to an Indigenous writer who's trying to reach that white audience. It's a better alternative than the genres that Indigenous writers were encouraged to write by publishers. They were encouraged to write something called salvage ethnography, which was basically their job was to sort of document this race that was believed to be disappearing. And so it was the Indigenous writer's job to sort of document their traditions, their beliefs, their folktales, etc., because they needed to be preserved, because the culture was on its way out. It was obsolete. They Indigenous people would be assimilated, and their cultures were just not going to exist anymore. Mourning Dove just did not buy that. And the thing about the Western narrative is that it enabled Mourning Dove to tell a different story, to tell the story of the Indigenous person in a modern context, because it dealt with that kind of moment of conflict between the colonizer and the Indigenous tribes. And so she appropriated the Western and indigenized it, used it to tell that's the story of the colonial experience. Salvage ethnography, they didn't want to see or they didn't want to hear the story of the modern Indigenous person. They wanted to hear the story of the kind of the pre-contact, pure, authentic. I, of course, am using scare quotes around all these words, right. But this idea of this authentic Indigenous cultures not touched by contact with the European, but the Western really enabled Mourning Dove to tell that story of the Indigenous people in the modern world. So that's why I think she wrote a Western.
And one of the more fascinating parts of Mourning Dove's novel that you describe is that she really takes at this point in the early 20th century, the budding field of anthropology and of salvage ethnography, she takes it to task within the book itself.
She does, yeah. The villain in the book comes to the reservation where the protagonist Kochewiya lives, and he gets this idea. He's an Easterner, an Eastern tenderfoot, and he gets the idea that Kochewiya it must be very wealthy. Because this is the period of the when a lot of reservation land was being divided up into parcels and then given to individuals in allotments. And so the villain believes that Kochewiya has a huge allotment and he wants to get his hands on it. And so he tries to seduce Kochewiya, and the way that he seduces her is by pretending to be fascinated with her culture. And he says, "Please just tell me your stories. I want to learn more about you. I'm so fascinated by your culture." And to me, this kind of dramatizes the colonial situation that Mourning Dove's community is in. Because on the one hand, the colonizers are sending their representatives to the reservations to collect, to write down the traditions and the stories and the belief systems and to witness rituals and so on. So they're pretending to have this fascination with the culture. But on the other hand, the colonizer is actively creating the conditions that are destroying that culture by going after the resources, the land that the indigenous people are living on. And so this kind of political situation is dramatized through that relationship between Kochewiya and this villain.
Earlier in the podcast, you described the process by which the genre of the Western became masculinized throughout the early 20th century.
Yeah.
Could I ask you to kind of reflect a little bit on maybe the state of the genre here in the early 21st century? Do you think that's changed at all, sort of across media from TV to literature to movies? Is the genre still a primarily masculine genre as it's presented in popular culture? Do you think that's changed somewhat over the last 100 years or so of Westerns?
Yeah, I think it has changed. Or rather, it's not so much that it's changed, but I think It's becoming what it's always been, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
I'm looking at a series like Westworld, where female figures are front and center in that series. There have been quite a few Western films produced that do feature female protagonists, but it's not just about the female protagonist, but it's also about the kinds of ideologies and the kind of philosophy that underpins the narrative. And that is something that's being disrupted in a lot of the more recent Westerns. I love the idea in Westworld of the sort of pure, virtuous female on the frontier who gradually over the course of the series transforms into a gunfighter. And that's exactly the narrative that Emma Gent Curtis wrote about in 1889. So it's kind of the same. So there's something familiar to me about these women-centered Westerns that we're seeing. But I don't think it's the case that we have this sort of new feminist Western that's finally been allowed to emerge. I think it's something that's always been there within the genre. And what happens is that kind of feminist impulse in the genre keeps emerging, and then it gets kind of written out of the history of the genre, and then it emerges again, and that, you know, and so even now we see it kind of come, we see these feminist Westerns happening, and the discourse around them kind of treats them like they're this anomaly instead of a kind of story that Westerns have been telling from the very beginning.
That might actually serve as an answer to this next question. But
okay.
If there is one takeaway that you hope readers come away from your book with, what would that be?
Yeah. One takeaway.
This is always a hard question when I ask it towards the end of my interviews, because it's a big one. So take some time to think if you need. It's okay.
Well, there's many takeaways, so it's hard to kind of arrive, or it's hard to just single out just one. But I guess I'd like them. I would like them to go and read these women. I guess I'd like these women to be read by more than just scholars like me. But I'd like them. I'd like be just. Lay readers or general readers, fans of the Western, to read us to discover these texts. And I think that can actually, to me, the genre of the Western is enriched by looking at all of the sort of tensions and conflicts and diversity that the genre can sustain. It's not just one story, but it's many different stories sort of butting up against each other and colliding with each other. You know, those diehard kind of Louis L'Amour readers, I want them to, I think their experience of Louis L'Amour can be enriched if they go and read B.M. Bauer and kind of see those writers in conversation with each other. I don't know. Is that a takeaway? It's something,
yes,
I'd like them to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a call to action.
Yeah. Yeah.
Since this is a book about books, and mm-hmm. since this was thus a podcast about books, mm-hmm. Can you tell us maybe just briefly something or a couple of things that you've read recently, either Westerns or non-Westerns, that you really enjoyed that you might want to recommend to our listeners?
Oh, well, in terms of books about Westerns, I mentioned Christine Bold's The Frontier Club. Mm-hmm. That book has just completely cracked open what we thought we knew about the Western and where it came from. So I think that is definitely a must read if you're interested in Westerns. And then are you thinking in terms of scholarly books or like
really just anything?
You anything? Know,
just because we've been talking about books for so long, I'm just curious what you've been into lately.
For recreational reading, I actually read a lot of contemporary domestic. I guess you would call it contemporary domestic fiction. Mm-hmm. I love books about sort of relationships that don't seem like much to the outside, but the people within those relationships, there's a lot going on, and it's so that's what I read when it's as far away from my field of study as I can get, and that way I feel like I don't have to write notes in the margins, I don't have to remember the characters' names, I don't have to read scholarly articles about them.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been reading. So the one I just finished reading is a book called The Mothers, and I can't remember the name. I think it's a relatively new writer, and Yeah.
Is it by Britt Bennett by any chance?
Yes. That's
it. I did a little Google searching while you were thinking out loud. So that,
yes.
That must be it.
Yeah. So I just finished reading that and I just loved it. And it's basically about the relationship between two women, and it's about how that relationship is mediated by men. But it's really the love between the women that is what is important. And a very subtle, I found it a very subtle and the characters very powerful in a really kind of quiet way. So yeah, that's what I just finished reading.
So now that this book has been out for a couple years, are you working on anything new? Do you have a next project coming down the pike at all?
I do. I'm working on a biography of B.M. Bauer. It's just about done. Hopefully one more summer and I'll be able to finish it. But B.M. Bauer was just a fascinating woman. I was lucky enough to meet some of her descendants and look through her papers. And so I've been working on that for a long time. Her grandson is patiently waiting for me to finish it. he helped me a lot, told me a lot of stories and shared a lot of family history and papers with me. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Well, best of luck as that heads into the home stretch.
Thank you so much.
Victoria Lamont is an associate professor of English at the University of Waterloo, and her new book is Westerns, A Women's History, which came out with the University of Nebraska Press in 2016. Thanks again for coming on the show today, Victoria.
Thanks for having me.